the Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I've listened closely to what the Right Honourable Gentleman had to say. At least no one could deny his claim to be an expert in the failures of governments. He gave some carefully selected figures of the record of his own government. Let me give a few more. Unemployment more than doubled under his government, from 600,000 to 1.2 million. Output per person rose by less than 3% over the 5 years between 1973 and 1978. Real disposable income per head fell in 1975, 1976 and 1977. And under the Labour government, inflation reached a peak of 27% per annum. In fact, the party he leads presided over the five most catastrophic years in Britain's post-war history. Nor is he any person to give lectures on cabinet disarray and disloyalty. Just read what one of his former cabinet colleagues said about him. 4th of December 1968.
Order.
Barbara Castle. I think Jim Callaghan is the most disloyal and damaging member of the whole government. Following year, she says, we'd taken care not to circulate any papers beforehand, knowing our Jim.
That's quite enough. Order! Order! There are two sides in this debate and each... Order! Order! The Leader of the Opposition had a reasonably fair hearing. And the Prime Minister is entitled to the same.
After barely 2 years in office, his party had brought Britain to the brink of total economic collapse. And the country was saved not by his or his party's efforts, but by Tory policies of monetary control and reduced public spending humiliatingly imposed by the International Monetary Fund. And fully supported by my Right Honourable and Honourable friends and me. Mr. Speaker, as the monetary medicine began to work, the Right Honourable Gentleman tried to assign the credit to his incomes policy which promptly collapsed about his ears as his own lifelong allies, the trade unions, rejected both it and him. Yeah. Having dithered over calling an election in 1978, he tried to buy off the industrial disruption of last winter and finally succumbed. Today, his party, increasingly infiltrated by people who wish to destroy the mixed economy altogether, advocates a return to the policies of excessive spending and excessive borrowing, which would lead inevitably to another collapse. When I hear the Right Honourable Gentleman doing his best to explain to us the nature of Britain's difficulties and the remedies he proposes, it's plain that he and his policies are part of our problem and they can never be part of the solution. The Right Honourable Gentleman referred to trade union matters, steel, monetary policy, minimum lending rate, earnings, etc. And I will try to deal with these points during the course of what I have to say. But may I first set the magnitude of the problem that we faced in its context. There is general agreement that Britain's problem is basically one of fast inflation since the early 1970s and a rate of economic growth which for the last third of a century at least has been slow in comparison with our competitors. While we were living fairly comfortably in the 1950s, our industries were failing to modernise themselves. Not so in other industrial countries. Faced by the destruction of the war, they were creating an industrial base to suit the needs of the second half of the century. Their industries were building for the future, but too many of ours were still living off their capital and former reputation. During that time, in the 1950s and 60s, we missed out on the rapid economic expansion which characterized the early years of the EEC. There was, Mr. Speaker, a continuous failure to recognise how far and how fast Britain was slipping. Governments planned over-optimistically for increases in public spending, which could only be justified on assumptions about economic growth which were seldom realised. Between 1963 and 1979, public spending as a percentage of GDP grew from 34 to 42%. Civil service expanded from 660,000 to 730,000. The numbers employed by local government leapt from 1.2 million to over 2 million. Thus, resources were drained away from the wealth-creating industry and commerce to the wealth-consuming public sector. Perhaps most significantly of all, the balance of power within our economy shifted as trade unions increasingly used their strength in key industries. The party opposite responded to these problems by putting public expenditure up by 9% over a period when GDP actually fell. Unemployment more than doubled during their stewardship. They legislated to put trade unions above the law. They gave them unprecedented new powers as part of the price for their temporary cooperation. That was the position when Britain voted for a new start and a new government. People wanted a government prepared to face the basic problems realistically. A government which regarded Parliament as paramount and which was not subservient to any other group, however powerful. People knew that the necessary changes would take time, but they wanted us to make a start right away. Now they expect us to do what we are elected to do and not to be deflected by the fears or the indignant cries of Labour politicians whom they sacked last May. Our objective is clear: to return to steady economic growth earned by people's own efforts in a free and responsible society. And our first priority is to restore sound money and conquer inflation. We don't pretend that that alone will be sufficient to revive our economy, but we know that it is the essential precondition. We know, too, that freedom and social justice will be in peril unless we can get inflation out of the economic system. The Right Honourable Gentleman and Honourable Members opposite challenge us because the retail price index has risen since the election. Let me remind the House what the Right Honourable Member for Leeds East said here on the 25th of January 1979. He said, "Let us assume, for example, that the increase in the nation's earnings in the current pay round is as high as 15%. The most obvious and inevitable consequence of this assumption coming true would be that the rate of inflation would probably reach about 13% by the end of the year." That was his prediction if wage increases reached 15%. The reality was that earnings over the last pay round rose not by 15%, but by 16-17%. So on the Right Honourable Member's own arithmetic, the rate of inflation would have been over 13% by the end of the year, and that before anything he would have done if he had continued as Chancellor on indirect taxes, and before the doubling of oil prices, which has added and will continue to add to the index. The charge that we have been responsible for all or even most of the price increases since the election is thus blatantly false. Honourable Gentleman rightly said, we did increase prices in the budget, value-added tax and other customs and excise duties. And the purpose of that increase, as the House knows, was to switch from direct to indirect taxes, thereby reducing tax on the pay packet, a cause which the Right Honourable Member opposite occasionally espoused when he was Chancellor, not frequently enough. Most of the other increases which he attributes to us are hardly our fault. Nationalised industry finances were rapidly moving out of control when we took office because of high settlements in the last pay round. Higher prices were the inevitable consequence. The Right Honourable Gentleman calls out gas and electricity. He knows that those matters were referred to his price commission, and his price commission on gas recommended far higher price increases than have been implemented. Far higher price increases than have yet been implemented. Milk prices to the farmer and distributor had to go up because the party opposite had delayed them before the election. The mortgage rate had to go up in spite of our efforts to get government borrowing down, and the spendthrift policies advocated by the opposition would have pushed them up even further. Yes, school meal charges have gone up from 25 pence in two stages to 35 pence.
If the
If the Right Honourable Lady will look behind her, she will discover the best reason for not allowing television cameras into the chamber.
I see that when I look at the Honourable Gentleman. Yes, school meals charges have gone up from 25 pence in two stages to 35 pence. But the former Secretary of State for Education put them up from 15 to 25 pence in one go, and she announced the increase from 25 to 30 pence well before the election. Mr. Speaker, experience shows that the only sure way of attacking inflation is to keep the money supply closely related to the output of goods and services. Whenever governments have not followed this simple rule, when money is in greater supply than goods, inflation has resulted. It doesn't require A-level economics or artificial labels. Artificial labels like monetarism to understand this. Even the Right Honourable Gentleman seemed to grasp it on 16th of January 1979 when he said in this House, "I make it clear that we do not intend as a government to finance inflation. We intend to adhere to monetary targets with inevitable effects both on the level of activity in the economy and on the level of unemployment." That was what the Right Honourable Gentleman said then. So we're determined to bring the growth of money supply down, and there are only two ways of doing this. One, by reducing the burden of government borrowing, and two, by ensuring that borrowing by the private sector does not grow too fast. If one or the other is too high, and if we are to achieve our monetary targets, interest rates inevitably have to rise. That's a situation we've been faced with. May I deal with government borrowing first? Government is borrowing too much because public spending is too high. But the Right Honourable Gentleman has scarcely been helping to get that down. The plans we took over from Labour were totally unrealistic, over 2% growth per year and no allowance for Clegg and the explosion in public service pay. The Clegg Comparability Awards, which the Right Honourable Gentleman left us to honour and pick up, are going to cost an extra $2,000 million next year. And last year's settlements for civil servants and local government staffs will cost another £1,000 million. By the time we took office, we were largely saddled with the opposition's plans for the present financial year. We cut them back as far as we could, £1.5 billion on programmes and another £1 billion through our policy on cash limits. Without that, government borrowing for this year would have been higher, and so too would interest rates. Yeah. Our revised plans for 1980-81 and later years will be published in a few weeks' time, and they will show substantial cuts on Labour's plans. The opposition will no doubt mount a chorus of complaint. In spite of the fact that a moment ago they were boasting that they were able to cut them by 6% in one year under the aegis of the IMF. But what are the alternative policies? Are the opposition suggesting that we put up income tax? They did that in 1974 and 1975. More and more people were brought into tax, and as a result, incentive and enterprise were destroyed. Are they suggesting we borrow even more and allow interest rates to rise still further? The Right Honourable Gentleman seemed to know the answer a year ago. In that same speech, he said, "What would be the result of a small increase in the quantity of money financing very large wage settlements of 20 or 30%. There could only be one result. The weakest firms would go to the wall and there'd be more unemployment. In addition, instead of easing interest rates, the country would be faced with a further tightening. The same holds true today. but for reasons of his own, the Right Honourable Gentleman chooses to ignore his own warnings. Now, Mr. Speaker, the opposition accuse us of being uncaring when we cut back certain spending programmes. Of course, there are many things we would like to do in the social field, but they can't all be done until we have a stronger economy. Yet, Mr. Speaker, we did provide for the pensioners' Christmas bonus last year. Moreover, we've introduced legislation to ensure it's paid annually. But in 1975 and 1976, there was no Christmas bonus for pensioners under Labour. Unlike the Labour government, we did abolish tax on war widows' pensions. Spending on the health service is not declining, and accusations that it is come ill from the party which between 1974 and 1979 decided to close over 250 hospitals. Education spending per pupil will continue to rise. But all of these matters, Mr. Speaker, are part of government spending and borrowing. And I referred earlier to private sector borrowing and its effect on the supply of money and inflation. In recent months, companies have been borrowing to finance not only high stocks, but pay settlements they simply can't afford. If they go on doing so, interest rates will stay high, there'll be less money available for new business and new jobs, and companies will fail. If that lesson is learned, the path to lower inflation will be shorter and less painful. But too many trade unions still seem determined to make demands which ultimately will inflict damage on themselves, on their fellow trade unionists, and on the rest of the community. And that's why, and this brings me to the second main point which the Right Honourable Gentleman mentioned, why we're determined to redress the balance of power in our society. Away from the trade unions and in favour of the individual, whether he be a member of a union, a consumer, a producer or taxpayer. After the events of last winter, under the Right Honourable Gentleman, when this country suffered the deepest indignities and insults at the hand of militant trade unionists, the standing of trade unions has seldom been lower in public esteem. For years, trade unions had campaigned for greater legal powers for themselves in industrial relations and employment. The last government increased those powers still further, until it seemed that whatever harm trade unions inflicted on others, neither individuals nor industry had any legal redress. But as well as a right to strike, there is a right to work. As well as the justice of a demand, there's the injustice that industrial action may inflict on others. As well as a loyalty to the union, there's a loyalty to family and to company. As well as a right to a decent wage, there's a duty to society to provide essential services. It had become abundantly clear that just as the unions had at one time sought redress from the arbitrary actions of employers, so today individuals, businesses and citizens were seeking protection from the power and might of trade unions. There is in this country a widespread view which we on this side endorse, that a person who is not a party to a trade dispute should be entitled to freedom to carry on his business and to go to work unhindered. And people feel that these rights should be protected by the law of the land. These feelings were the origins of the government's employment bill now going through the House. It will no doubt be vigorously opposed by some trade union leaders, by the militants and the party opposite, but not by the rank and file trade unionists. Not by the overwhelming majority of the British people. The militants will oppose the provision for secret ballots. They don't wish the silent majority to be heard, even on matters which vitally affect their members' future. But the rank and file want it, even if the TUC General Council don't. The militants will oppose the provisions which restrict picketing to the place of work of the picket. But those who have been at the receiving end of secondary picketing, at Sheerness and Hadfields, those will welcome the provisions on picketing. The militants will fight fiercely the provisions on closed shop, which give the individual redress against the employer or the union, or in some cases both. But the ordinary members believe that the remedy is long overdue. Some trade union leaders will object to the sections in the Employment Bill which prevent a repetition of the injustices practiced by the Slade Union. Injustices which were the subject of an inquiry, and an inquiry to which the union refused even to give evidence. But those who work in the industry have been pleading for just this protection. The Employment Bill begins to redress the balance of power in favour of individuals and those not involved in a trade dispute. Some trade union leaders will acknowledge that what we are doing has to be done. Most trade union members know it beyond all doubt. The more quickly and smoothly we can make these changes, the more justice will seem to be done. The sooner trade unions will return to public favour and the quicker our economy will recover. Now, the Right Honourable Gentleman said a number of things about industrial policy. And of course there are many other changes which are necessary to improve the operation of our mixed economy. Government's job is to create the economic climate which will result in new jobs and present investment being used more effectively. First, yes, we on this side want to increase incentives and reward for extra effort, unlike the opposition. My Right Honourable Friend, the Chancellor made a start last year. We want a bigger gap between income in work and income out of work. Second, in contrast to the opposition, we believe that goods are produced more efficiently through competition in the private sector than under the monopoly protection of the public sector. Hence our programme on which we've started, of denationalisation wherever this is possible. Third, Mr. Speaker, there's much evidence that large firms, large plants, large organisations are more prone to industrial discontent than smaller units. And it's particularly to small firms that we have to look for many of the jobs of the future. And that's where tax incentives and the reduction of controls are so important. Further, we are studying how best we can achieve the move towards smaller units in both nationalised and private industry. Fourth, Britain's industrial problems are not only those of low productivity, but in too many areas there are defects of quality, design and delivery. This government has restored to management the freedom and responsibility to manage. And we expect them to use it to improve their industry's performance. Government, however, can and will help to influence these matters by policy on public sector purchasing and on research and development. And fifth, we must adapt to today's markets. We've recognised fully the problems of Britain's declining industries and those who work in them. Industries which have similar problems in most of the older industrialised countries. These adjustments cannot take place overnight, whether in steel, shipbuilding or railways.
Will order. I think it's very unfair of honourable gentlemen. Order, no. Nobody should have to fight for a hearing in this place. Order. Prime Minister.
The adjustments, whether in steel or shipbuilding, have to be made, and the longer they are delayed, the more they tie up resources which could be deployed in new ventures. But we mustn't flinch from the realities. It's easy for politicians to win applause by postponing the day of reckoning. But that is only self-indulgence and deceit. It is what the opposition practiced with relation to these industries in the past. The Right Honourable Gentleman referred to the present dispute in British Steel. It shows just what happens when people refuse to face the facts. The last government poured taxpayers' money into British Steel Corporation to cover their losses, well over £1,000 million for that purpose over the 5 years they were in office. This year, even before the strike, British Steel Corporation were heading for a loss of over £300 million, and that this government was prepared to finance. But we're not prepared to go on funding losses in 1980-81. In May 1978, the Right Honourable Member for Chesterfield endorsed the British Steel Corporation's aim of breaking even by 1979-80, this financial year. But his Right Honourable friend now wants us to go on for providing for losses, not just this year, but next year as well, and no doubt the year after that and the year after that. British Steel Corporation have offered a minimum of 14.4% in return for agreements on productivity. They say there is scope for considerably more for those who want to earn it. The fact is, the dispute could end tomorrow on the basis of a substantial pay settlement for the steel workers. Now, the Right Honourable Gentleman, Mr. Speaker, put forward some proposals about what ACAS could do. The truth is that ACAS already have powers to appoint a conciliator, a mediator, or an arbitrator with the consent of both parties. They do not need these powers. They already have them, and they could do them. And British Steel Corporation has said, that they would have either a mediator or an arbitrator, but the trade unions have refused it. That is the position. All of the powers are, in fact, already there. They could be used, but it is the trade unions who will not, in fact, use them, even though the members of the ISTC went out on strike without a ballot and without strike pay and have now been out for some 9 weeks and have been without good pay packets for that time and could have had increased pay packets for that time. Failure to reach a settlement can mean only two things: continued loss of earnings for steel workers and their families, and a worse prospect for the industry. The longer the strike continues, the harder it will be for British Steel Corporation to get their business back and to achieve profitability, and the risk of greater redundancies will grow. But I stress, we cannot hand over more taxpayers' money to an industry where earnings are already well above the national average and which has already received so much. We recognise the special problems which closures and redundancies are going to cause, especially in Wales. And that's why the British Steel Corporation have allocated a substantial sum for redundancy payments out of the £450 million cash limit for next year. And that's why my Right Honourable friend, the Secretary of State for Wales, announced on the 4th of February the allocation of an additional £48 million to be spent over the next 2 years in the areas affected by the rundowns at Llanwern and Port Talbot. At a time when we're having to cut public spending, The allocation of these funds on top of what would otherwise have been available to the Welsh Office is a clear sign of our determination to take effective action. Yeah. Mr. Speaker, I spoke earlier about the wish of the British people last May for a new start and for a government prepared to tackle the country's problems. We've been in power for less than 10 months. But already we've been having to take hard decisions which the Right Honourable Gentleman could not or would not face. Decisions to cut their irresponsibly inflated spending plans and to try to give the taxpayer and ratepayer value for money. Decisions to restore incentives by getting personal taxes down. Decisions to enable council house tenants to become homeowners and to give a charter of rights to remaining tenants. Decisions to reduce waste in the public service. Decisions to honour our defence obligations to our own people and to our allies. Decisions to provide the British people with better protection against violent crime at home. Decisions to restore confidence abroad, not only in our currency, but in Britain as an influence in the world. All these things we were pledged to do, and with all of them we've made a firm start and achieved a good measure of success. Despite the need to retrench, we made last year the biggest ever increase in pensions and social security benefits. We've taken special steps to help the disabled, the one-parent families and war widows. We've made the biggest ever cuts in personal taxes, benefiting all taxpayers, increasing allowances to double what was needed to offset the previous year's inflation. And we're doing pretty well abroad. The pound is a strong currency, free of exchange controls for the first time in 40 years. If in 1975, after its first 10 months, the Labour government could have pointed to a record of achievement even remotely comparable with this, boasting. As it were, they were still floundering amid policies already doomed to failure. We're facing Britain's long-standing and deep-rooted problems with firmness and realism, which is exactly what the British people want. Attitudes are changing, as we have seen at Sheerness, at Hadfields, at South Wales, and the mode of realism is spreading fast. Perhaps it will never spread to the opposition, which is why the country finally rejected the policies of yesterday at the election. And that's why I ask the House today to reject decisively their motion, thereby expressing confidence in Her Majesty's government.